Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 127 on coprolite inclusions. So it's very rare in PaleoCast that we interview two different people in a single episode, but here I speak to two Martins, Martin Kvarnström and Martin Fikarczyk of Uppsala University and National Sun Yat-sen University respectively. In the episode, I'll be referring to them as Martin Q and as Martin F. So Martin Q researches coprolites and Martin F beetles. Now, a lot of you may already be familiar with this story. It's been doing very well in the news. But for those of you who don't yet know it, well, you've probably already guessed the story correctly by now anyway. A beetle in a coprolite. It's a pretty cool find, right? And that's where most coverage of this story would end. But we're not just any media outlet. As a specialist paleontological podcast, we're not afraid to peel back layers of detail and dig deep into the significance of any discovery. And this interview really does deliver. In this first part, we'll set the context, taking a look at both the study of coprolites and of beetles. And then in the second half, we'll explore the details of the discovery itself. Before we start though, just a tiny bit of admin. Congratulations to Matthew and Gavi, who Elsa picked as winners for last episode's competition, and thanks to everyone who entered, we had a lot of excellent responses. As you may have noticed, I'm now back from oil work for a few weeks at least, so expect some more regular content. But if you're feeling you're not getting enough PaleoCast, please check out the PaleoCast Gaming Network, where we post weekly videos about extinct organisms in computer games. Please also remember to check out our website for images that accompany this episode and all of the usual likes, shares, subscribes, donations, comments, and any kind of engagement all really helps the show to grow. I hope you enjoy this episode and part two will be released in a couple of weeks' time. So, hi, Martin and Martin, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for letting us be on the show.
So, Martin Q, starting with you, can you tell us your route into paleontology?
Absolutely. So, I started to study geology in southern Sweden, in Lund, and it wasn't like I was super into paleontology when I started studying geology. It was I was more interested in sedimentology and, you know, like overall history of Earth and so on. But little by little, I started being more interested in sedimentology and paleontology. And then when it was time for my master's thesis, I teamed up with paleontologists here in Uppsala and made a project about early tetrapods, although it was still very sedimentology based. But then I got stuck because it's so interesting and cool. And ever since then, I've been studying fossils instead. So I've done a PhD here in Uppsala, mostly on coprolites, actually. I love it.
So you're studying coprolites. Can you tell us what they are and how did you develop an interest in them?
Yeah, that was also a little bit, I shouldn't say a mistake, but I started looking at some thin sections of coprolites together with my previous PhD supervisor, Grzegorz Niedzwiecki, who is also a co-author of this new paper here. And we saw a lot of interesting things in these coprolites, but based on the thin sections, we just saw them in 2D. But we realized that there is a lot of potential in the coprolites to preserve various food remains, and that would be really interesting to look at these remains and try to reconstruct interactions of various extinct animals, so diets and parasitism and stuff like this. And then we decided to scan a lot of coprolites because the problem is that even if they would contain a lot of food remains, it's very hard to know where they would be in the coprolites, and coprolites are not transparent, so you really have to find a way of imaging what's inside the coprolites. So we scanned a lot of the coprolites using the using synchrotron microtomography, and most of my PhD work was based on that data, actually.
Okay, so let's break it all down into the very basics. Like, what actually is a coprolite?
So a coprolite is a fossilized dropping. And we can use coprolites to look at diets and parasitism and so on of extinct animals, and we can use a lot of them to get a better understanding of ancient ecosystems, to start to reconstruct and rebuild these food webs and try to understand who ate whom, for example.
Yeah, it sounds like there's so much information you can get from them. But first, I want to actually get one out of a rock. How do you go out into the field as a paleontologist and identify a coprolite amongst all the rocks?
It can be very simple, because it could look like something your dog produced earlier in the morning. And it can also be really, really difficult. So if we think about coprolites from carnivorous animals, it's usually easier because they're sausage shaped and they're phosphatic in composition, so they really stand out from most sedimentary rocks, and they really look like feces, they look like droppings. But when it comes to coprolites from herbivorous animals, it could be more tricky, because it could just look like a patch of sediment with like fragmented pieces of plants in them, and most people wouldn't be able to recognize those as coprolites. So you have the whole spectrum there. It can be super simple and very, very hard to identify them. But having said that, coprolites are pretty common in the fossil record. So if we're out at a dig site and there is tons of bones there, there are pretty high chances that we find quite a lot of coprolites as well. And if you think about that a little bit, like, of course, the preservation potential of a single dropping is really, really low. But if you take one vertebrate, it produces one skeleton and potentially thousands of droppings, right? So the preservation potential like increases with the sheer number. So it's a probability thing.
Okay. And that is looking just at vertebrate droppings. If we look at invertebrate droppings, are they similar? Can we find more, or are they rarer?
No, absolutely. You have coprolites, deep down in the Cambrian and up to now, and of various sorts of sizes and so on, and a lot of pellets produced by various invertebrates, for example, as well. Then the question is, of course, how much information you can find within them. So you have, for example, a lot of trace fossils where you can see these associated small pellets or small coprolites. But it could be very hard to get any information from some of them, of course. But there are various different coprolites from the fossil record. Everything from, these tiny invertebrate coprolites to huge coprolites produced by Tyrannosaurids, for example. So there is a wide range of different coprolites.
Yeah, I remember from my geology undergrad that you can get something called pilloidal limestone, which is effectively just an entire rock just made out of these little pellets, which is incredible that there can be so much. So obviously those tiny little pellets are made by tiny little animals, and the big ones filled with bones are made by carnivorous animals. But other than that, can you actually tell which animal produced any given coprolite? Is that even possible?
That's a very good question, because this is the trickiest part, I would say, of working with coprolites. So of course, if you think about, like, there are not so many characters in the coprolites that we can use. Sometimes there is like spirality, for example. If you have spiral coprolites, they derive from a producer with a spiral gut valve. So for example, various sharks or dipnoans, for example. But otherwise, if we just have size and a few other things to go on, it can be very, very tricky. And if we look at modern animals, for example, you can see that different types of animals can produce similar looking feces and vice versa. So it's one animal, one individual even can produce feces that looks very different from day to day or depending on what they eat, for example. So it's tricky. But what we have to do is use all the information we have. So size of the coprolites, association to body fossil record, contents, shape, and so on. And then we can try to puzzle together the whole story and get the links from, you know, what we know from the body fossils to the trace fossils. It's not easy. Sometimes it's possible and you can have a really good idea of who produced a certain type of coprolite from a dig site, for example. And sometimes, you know, it's impossible to say something about that.
Okay, so with trace fossils, there's a parallel nomenclature. So with animals, you have the binomial nomenclature, say Tyrannosaurus rex. With ichnofossils, you also get names for certain traces, and that would include coprolites. So my question is, are there different named trace fossils, different coprolites, that are produced by a single organism? So I don't want to go into too much detail, but not all poops are the same, as I'm sure we all know. And so are there different kind of morphologies of poops that are created by one animal that we know about?
I see what you mean here. So there are several answers to this question. So first of all, I don't like to use ichnotaxonomy for coprolites at all. So we just, you know, group together different coprolites based on a shape and so on. But then we try to, you know, find as much evidence on feeding and stuff like that, and not so much, you know, classification, because as you're saying here, it's really tricky, and it could be. You know, you can assign various different coprolites, different names and so on, but then in the end they will be produced by the same animal or vice versa. So I'm trying to avoid that as much as possible because, as we were talking about previously, we don't have so much information about the producer based on just, you know, the shape and size of coprolites. But if you look at modern animals, for example, you can make some distinctions based on size. So, for example, you can compare scat from, say, foxes and wolves, and you can see that the diameters, they follow this like normal distribution, and then you have a little bit overlap. But in general, you can see that the droppings produced by wolves, not surprisingly, are slightly bigger than those produced by foxes. And we could use this kind of similar way of thinking about these things working on the coprolites. So in many cases, we get the most probable or most likely producer of these coprolites. And in other cases, we could be fairly sure, actually, who produced it. So we have one example of really big coprolites from a site. And there's just really one really big carnivorous animal. And on top of that, we even found teeth of this guy in the coprolite. So it was chewing bone and then swallowing its own teeth as they broke. So in this case, we were very, very sure about the producer of the coprolites. And in other cases, it's going to be super difficult.
That's fascinating that you can get so much information out of them. So you've mentioned before the inclusions, the bits of bone, some of your own teeth. I've never had that happen, but I'm sure all these animals, it might be possible. What other kinds of things can we find in there as inclusions? And then next, what other kinds of information can we get from coprolites just in general?
So when it comes to which types of inclusions are preserved in coprolites, it's just what we can expect to be there, of course, is food remains, so whatever was not completely digested by the producer, remains of parasites, bacteria, and whatever colonized the feces after it was deposited. And then, of course, you can add involuntarily ingested objects, for example, and so on. It turns out that all these things, once if they end up in a coprolite or in a dropping, and that dropping against all odds becomes preserved as a fossil, these things preserve very, very well. And we really find all these kinds of things. And in some cases, of course, the food remains would be really hard to identify because they're just very small bits and pieces of something that was chewed up and swallowed and then went through the whole digestive system of the producer. But in other cases, they're kind of nice and we can actually identify what they are. So food remains, parasites, and especially parasite eggs, because that's how a lot of parasites spread, right? They lay their eggs, they get expelled via the feces, and then they can spread to other hosts. And then the tricky part is to extract that information. So we can either, you know, use destructive measures, and we can make thin sections and look at 2D sections of the coprolites, or we can scan them like we have done and reconstruct these using various softwares. But yeah, really, all kinds of food remains are preserved in coprolites, and we can, of course, use them to understand the diets of various extinct animals. And if you think about it, if we look at one coprolite that was produced by one individual, and we're able to link back the coprolite to the producer, we can say something what that particular animal was doing just before it took that dump. But if we scale up and look at more coprolites at the same time from a locality, and we're able to assign different types of coprolites, so different morphologies to different animals that we know from the body fossil record, we can start to get an overall idea of the entire food webs based, because this is important, based on direct evidence of feeding. It's not just like, okay, we have these and these animals. It looks based on the teeth, for example, that they were eating this and that. But here we actually have, we know that there was an animal A that was eating this and this, and it's most likely this guy from the body fossil record. Okay, that was a really dumb example, but you see what I mean.
Yeah, it can tell you so much about their ecology. But if we think about what poop actually is, it's not just the food that you've ingested, but it's all your waste products as well. Is there, well, can you tell that much detail about the producer itself of the waste that they make? There's all old blood cells and stuff in there. Can you see any of that?
So when it comes to these things that are completely mineralized, it's really hard. It's going to be a mix of everything, right? Like from everything from the producer, from the gut biota, from whatever colonized the feces after, and so on. So it would be really difficult to distinguish what is what. And you can even see that in archaeological studies, that in some cases you can have bacteria preserved in the coprolites, or in this case coprolites meaning like desiccated fecal matter that match the gut biota of modern humans, but it could also match like bacteria from compost and so on, because of course you would have like a colonization of the feces as soon as it's deposited by various bacteria and so on. So I would say it's very difficult, but what we can see when we look closely at coprolites is that they often contain small remnants of bacteria, so small like pseudomorphs of bacteria, so small spheres. You can see the bacteria have been eating the fecal matter, or and at the same time being involved in mineralizing it. So we know that the preservation of coprolites is heavily influenced by bacterial activity.
Oh, that's fascinating. And finally, to round off this bit on coprolites, what do you tell people you do when they ask you? You know, just like you've just met, I don't know, someone in the street, and they're saying, what do you do for a job? What do you tell them, and how do they react?
Well, it depends on who I'm talking with and like my mood. But if I go for the whole coprolite stuff, of course, some people think it's really, really enjoyable and nice and interesting, and other people think you're a complete idiot. So sometimes I avoid going into too much details because it sounds really weird to people. But surprisingly often people are super interested in coprolites and paleontology in general. So it's really interesting for me to like tie together everything we know from coprolites to, you know, the rest of the fossil record, see what we can do with coprolites that we can't do with other types of fossils and so on. So I think people find poop and coprolites in general quite funny. So it's a very easy way to communicate your science to people and kids and so on. And I think that's a lot of fun.
Okay. Right. Speaking of subjects that are incredibly interesting, but some people may not think so, beetles. So, Martin F., can you tell us about your route into paleontology and why you started studying fossilized beetles?
In my case, it was two-step. I'm actually not a paleontologist. Even now, I would not identify myself as a paleontologist. I'm mostly working with modern beetles. So what you can find today, actually, I just returned from the field work and I collected many beetles which are living today, right? So my kind of entrance to paleontology was a total accident. At the time when I was finishing my master's, actually, we got a new professor at our department in Prague, Charles University, who is basically the only paleoentomologist in the Czech Republic. And before that, and actually even at that moment, I always considered fossils as something like, you know, like super boring. It's like not really living. It's not moving. It's a piece of stone. It's like flat. It's like black spot on the stone. This was my idea of a fossil. And I remember that once this professor, who later became my supervisor of my PhD, once he entered the department, he had something like a big talk about what he is doing just to introduce himself. And it was so boring. I was basically sleeping all over the talk, right? And I woke up only for one moment. And at this very moment, he was showing the fossils of the group I'm working on. And I was like, wow. This is a fossil of my group of beetles. I never saw anything like that. So immediately after the talk, I basically went to his office and I told him, like, can you show me this beetle? Because I never saw any fossil and that's kind of interesting. So he showed me that. It's actually quite big beetle. So it was like really nice fossil, quite young, much younger than what we were describing now from the coprolite. And we somehow started to chat and we wrote a short paper about this beetle. And later, basically, I joined his lab for my PhD and I was working on the fossil record of Hydrophilus, a water scavenger beetles, which is my main subject for the studies like in the modern beetles. So it was really a total accident. If I would not wake up at that very moment, I would not be even into fossils until now.
So, sorry, were you literally asleep?
Yeah, I was sleeping. It was so boring. It was strong, you know, it's like, and you always have the insects. Nowadays, you have very nice insects, like fossil insects from some localities in China. You have tons of Burmese amber finks and so on. But most of these things were kind of starting at that time still. So they were like most fossils this professor was showing were kind of pieces of wings or something like that. It was so boring. And only later I discovered naturally that it's super interesting, but it's kind of, you know, like a student who is kind of very narrow-minded and only interested in one super good group of beetles, which I selected. I was kind of ignorant to anything else. So that's why it was not that it was boring or not interesting. I was just stupid.
I mean, to be honest, I think I was in pretty much the same boat. For me, it was skateboarding. I would always skip lectures and stuff and go out. And there was a great skate spot just at the university. So we'd always just jump out of class and go and skate down the side of the building. But yeah, caught a good paleo lecture. And here we are, like 20 years later or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Beetles, though. So you said, yeah, black spots on rocks, but then some are actually really nice. How well do they typically preserve as fossils?
Actually, beetles, we have actually many, many, many fossils of beetles, and mostly they are quite nice, at least on the first view. The reason for that is that most beetles have very hard skeletons, right? So we have many insects, but many of them are, you can imagine something like a mosquito. And this is something which you can easily like smash once it's sucking your blood, you just smash it and you completely smash the insect, right? So this cannot really so easily survive in the fossil record, because during the fossilization process, there are also some kind of big pressures and kind of geological processes which all these fossils has to go through. And all these weak insects are not that easy to survive these. But beetles, they typically have very hard skeleton, so they are very frequently preserved. And so we have many of them, but unfortunately, mostly they are just isolated elytra, so this like hardened first pair of wings. We cannot do much with that. There are in old times many, like from really old fossils, we only have the elytra. So there was even the parallel taxonomy done for the isolated elytra, which was total mess. We nowadays don't even use it, these things, but in old times it was usual. But actually, we can also find more complete beetles, and they are quite frequent in the compressed fossils. The problem is that the beetle is kind of made two-dimensional, made totally flat. So we have all these structures which normally are like 3D. You have kind of smashed them in one over the other. So it's sometimes not easy to interpret actually what is what. Then recently, actually, there are very many beetles nicely preserved in embers, in different kinds of embers. And that actually is really amazing, not only for beetles, for all kinds of insects, including these soft-bodied ones, because ember is basically something like a microscopic slide. Like ember is like the fossilized resin of the trees. And this is actually how we even made the microscopic slides in old times ourselves. Like the scientists used the resin of the Canadian fir, I think, which is called Canada balsa. And they made the microscopic slides basically in the way as the ember was produced. It was just not fossilized naturally, and it was done more carefully. So you can have nice slide with nice animal seeing all the structure. This was not happening in old times. It was just nature was doing that. So sometimes the beetles or other insects are in some weird positions and you cannot really see everything. But otherwise, you basically can see all the details. You can see hairs, you can see individual, like, eye pieces, you can see all the microscopic details as in modern animals. It's like as it would die a few minutes ago. So in embers, we have many, many kinds of fossils. And that's basically it. Then sometimes we have some kind of weird fossils, some kind of 3D encrusted things, but this is super rarely found. So basically ember and compressed fossils are the main things we can find for beetles.
Okay, and is it a lot more common to find these elytra? So am I right in thinking the elytra is what I would describe as kind of like the wing case over the abdomen, the thing that splits when the wings come out?
Yeah, precisely. This is this. And that's actually very easily getting out if the beetle decays. This elytra gets out and they can get preserved quite frequently. So in some old times, like typically from this Triassic or Jurassic times, which is when actually this Triamyxa, this coprolite beetle is from, earlier we mostly had just isolated elytra because it's most easy to get preserved.
And they are developmentally a pair of wings, aren't they? They're modified wings.
Yeah. It's basically like all insects have two pairs of wings, right? And in beetles, and actually also in some other groups not related to beetles, like in cockroaches, for example, the first pair of wings became kind of hardened and changed the function from the flying kind of part of the body, which is allowing the flight, to protective. So there, it's basically the first pair of wings which is protecting the second pair of wings, which is made for flying, from damage. So beetles actually can kind of, you know, like crawl into some spaces, some small crevicles, and hide there without actually damaging their second pair of wings using for flight. So it's kind of an adaptation how to make the beetle cryptic and at the same time make it able to fly.
Okay, and so we're limited to where we can find great fossils of beetles, so in amber, as you say, and then the rest of the fossils are all flattened, compressed, carbonized. Do we see them as being hyper-diverse? Because we know they're hyper-diverse today. Are they just as diverse in the past, or are there just a handful of different species?
And it's actually kind of difficult to guess or difficult to be certain about. But we surely have. So the oldest beetles actually go back something like 300 million years ago. This is when we know it is a German locality and the Czech locality, actually. So both are European. We know the oldest beetles from roughly the same time. That's from these two things. And since then, naturally, the diversity and number of species and lineages we know was kind of rising, right? But we still don't have actually much information about the oldest times, so we don't really know. The thing we know that there are some groups which definitely were more diverse in the past than they are today. So, for example, we have a small suborder of beetles called Archostemata, which today has something like 45 species only in four families. And if we look at the fossils, it actually goes from the Permian to, let's say, Cretaceous. We have many, many more species, genera, families, you know, like, so this group was probably really much more diverse in the past than it is today. It's later because it's one of the most kind of ancient looking group of beetles with the kind of supposedly the primitive lifestyle. It was probably kind of outcompeted by all the new groups of beetles which evolved later. So these kind of take the race, and these ancient beetles kind of mostly got extinct probably and survived in few lineages. And we know the same in few other occasions. So for example, for the weevils, nowadays, this is one of the most diverse group of beetles, actually, as well. In the Jurassic or Cretaceous, you cannot find a real weevil, like a true weevils, which we have now, or they are pretty rare, actually. But you have some other groups, which originally they were described as different families. Nowadays, we suppose mostly that they are kind of early ancestors of modern families. But also they were very diverse. They just later got extinct and got kind of replaced by these modern weevils. So we can see that in many different places of the beetle time tree. But naturally, we still need more and more fossils. So that's why I hope that the coprolites can show something.
Yeah, and just as a final note, is it hard to do comparative anatomy when you find a fossilized beetle? And then you compare it to something modern. And, well, for me, as someone who looks at horseshoe crabs, for instance, I could find the horseshoe crab fossil and then compare it to the modern ones. And I've only got four different species to compare it to. It's quite easy. But when you find your fossil beetle, you compare it to the billion beetles that are alive today. Is it hard to do? And are there enough paleo entomologists looking at beetles to make your jobs easier?
It's not easy, definitely, because we have too many beetles, right? We have like 350,000 described species and probably many more undescribed. So it's kind of crazy work, actually, if you can imagine. So once I got the request from Martin Q, like, okay, we have this beetle in the coprolite. Can you help us to identify? My first reaction was like, I freaked out because, okay, how can I compare with everything? You know, it's so old, it can be totally anything. It can be some ancestor of any group which looks totally different from what is living today, for example. But fortunately, there were some good studies of modern beetles, which is what we actually need for the identification of fossils, published quite recently. So, for example, there's a group of people led by the Australian researcher who made something like a big table of several hundreds of characters for all the families, and in many cases also like many different things within each family. So this is kind of the big matrix of data which we can nowadays use for this comparative purposes. Many people kind of criticize that, okay, it's just morphology, it's not DNA, it's not the, you know, the modern style of work which like the modern beetle scientists should do today and so on. But actually for the work with fossils, this is actually really treasure. So we were using this actually. So we have all the data about the modern beetles already in the table. And we actually can add any fossils. So in our case, we added the Triamyxa, but I already before used it for another fossils. You just code the characters, which you can see, which naturally never are all the characters which you can see in modern beetles. Some of them you cannot see, some of them you are not sure about, so you have to be really careful. But you code what you really can see, and then you actually let the computer to analyze that and kind of give you some guess. And actually you have to kind of be careful. Sometimes you get some artifacts, sometimes you get some multiple possible hypothesis, so we have to kind of little bit figure out what it can be, but it's nowadays actually quite easily possible.
Phylogenetics is such it's not very tangible as a concept. It's something that we struggle so much to explain in just audio, trying to explain family trees and matrices and all of that. It's really hard to get your head around unless you've actually done it. But anyway, you've mentioned then that we've got a beetle in a coprolite, which I'm sure anyone listening to this could have figured out this is the direction that this interview is going in. So, Martin Q, I'm guessing you made the discovery as someone that was looking at the coprolites. Were you surprised when you found it? Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.